Hello and welcome to the 15 Minute Book Club, our regular look at all things book related, with me, your host, David Wares, ably assisted by part-time assistant to the weekend under-librarian, aka producer Wilson.
Good evening.
We are sequestered in the dusty loft of the semi-abandoned Great Winter Library, somewhere in the twilight waste of the north, from where we spend our days filing all library cards, speaking in hushed tones, and repairing and remaindering ancient texts, and from where we take a regular 15-minute tea break to look at all things book-related, as in this show. And this can be a review, an interview, a classic, a bestseller, a focus on a particular writer, genre, or theme, a question of some sort, whatever. We're all about the written word. What are we about, Producer Wilson?
The word that is written.
Exactly. And we're kicking off this edition with the question, what is your guilty reading pleasure? What do you read that if you were asked, you might not really want to admit to? Or you might do, I don't know. Are you a secret Catherine Kirkson fan? Do you enjoy Jeremy Archer? Do you read 50 Shades of Grey in the bath when no one's looking? Are you a secret fan of chick lit or an avid reader of ghost-written thrillers by number from former members of the SAS? Anyway, my guilty pleasure, a large part of my reading habit, in fact, too large a part, is cheap formulaic thrillers and action novels, preferably including a flawed hero, a treacherous female antagonist cum love interest, and many layers of double dealing, preferably also 300 pages long and not requiring a single ounce of effort from me, and most likely to skim over things like plot and character development. Because as Raymond Chandler once said, when he ran out of plot ideas, you just have to have a man come through a door holding a gun. Anyway, that's my literary comfort food. What's yours, Producer Wilson?
I like a bit of Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes. And dear listener, let me know what yours is. Get in touch. Tell us about your reading habits, either through the site platform or via my direct email at jazzpunk101@protonmail.com. And if you have any recommendations, a comment, an observation, or just something to get off your chest, I'm always open to suggestions and ideas, as well as bribes and cake. And I'll read out the best answers in future episodes. Okay, moving on to this week's book focus. Then the book is A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf. First of all, I'll give you a little bit of an overview of Virginia Woolf, just in case you're not an expert, as to be honest, as I'm not really. But she was born in 1882 to an affluent family in Kensington, London, which is an affluent part of London. As an adult, she was a member of the influential Bloomsbury group of artists, thinkers and writers. She helped set up the Hogarth Press, and she is the author of a number of novels, including one of my favourites, Orlando, a Biography, and another one, Mrs. Dalloway, as well as a number of others. She's acknowledged as an important early 20th century feminist thinker and writer. And though she was very successful in one lifetime, she suffered from depression and quite possibly bipolar disorder. And at the age of 59, she took her own life. So an interesting character, even if you don't read the book, she's worth investigating. But the book itself, A Room of One's Own, I first read this just after I left school. And looking back, I have to ask, what did a 17-year-old unemployed academic failure, that is me, see in a book written by a wealthy, upper-class, proto-feminist from the early part of the 20th century? Because this book wasn't written for me, or even people like me. The book itself is a combination of two talks that Woolf gave at Newham and Girton Colleges in October 1929 to an audience of upper-class, educated women who had been given the opportunity to study at Cambridge University. She did not give those talks for a council estate brat like me. The fact is, Woolf said, the lower classes are detestable. And yes, she was talking about me and possibly Producer Wilson as well.
I would have thought so.
So we need to be honest at this point. Virginia Woolf, one of the greatest English writers of the early part of the 20th century, was an absolute snob. Her attitude towards her own servants, and yes, she had servants who washed her smalls, cleaned her room, made her meals and tidied up a mess, essentially every task that needed doing that an upper-class woman would not dream of doing herself, that her attitude towards her own servants was, at best, not pleasant. She had no feeling for them. She had no conception of any commonality or shared humanity. Her feminism, proto or otherwise, was very much aimed at the refined, educated, upper-class woman. And some would argue that in much of mainstream feminism, not much has changed. You can discuss that yourself. I'm not going to get too involved in that. Whatever, Virginia was not for the poor. She was not for those who worked with their hands. She was a wealthy Victorian by birth. So expecting her to be otherwise Well, it would be like expecting a 21st century lecturer in the sociology of TikTok to be also an avid proponent of colonialism, or to expect a member of the Green Party to campaign for the opening of dozens of coal-fired power stations, because Wolf was, quite simply, a creature of her time. It's worth bearing in mind, too, that Wolf's suffrage, that women's suffrage, had only been granted in 1928, which was the year before the talks to make up this book were given. And that was only 10 years after universal suffrage had been granted to men, which happened at the end of the Great War. Before and during the war, in which 900,000 British men died, working class men did not have the vote either. The patriarchy, as it was back then, and I suspect as it is now, extended purely to the rich men in the drawing room. It did not extend to poor men below stairs or down to mine or on the factory floor. The patriarchy did not extend to Tommy Atkins and his pals, enduring 4 years of slaughter in the trenches. In the early part of the 20th century, class was the great divide. But having said all that, Virginia Woolf, affluent, educated, snobbish, no doubt, is still a great writer. And the points she made in a room one-to-one were made in a persuasive, sympathetic and encompassing manner. The point of the book was to explore and critique the limitations on women's freedom, to highlight their inability at that time to speak and act freely, and describe how women were not in charge of their own destiny, but rather were subject to the dictates of their menfolk. In particular, Wolf relates how difficult it was for a woman like her to become a writer. She explained that she needed a private income of £500 a year and a room of her own in order to be able to write, hence the title. And as part of the speech, she invents a character, Judith Shakespeare, sister of the bard, a woman as talented as her brother William, but unable to succeed because she lived in a world where women's lives were strictly delineated according to custom and expectation. As she says, while William went about the world creating genius, Judith, his extraordinarily gifted sister, remained at home. She was an adventuress, as imaginative, as agog to see the world as he was. But she was not sent to school. She had no chance of learning grammar and logic, let alone of reading Horace and Virgil. She picked up a book now and then, one of her brothers perhaps, and read a few pages. But then her parents came in and told her to mend the stockings or mind the stew, and not moon about with books and papers. Wolf goes on to describe Judith facing an arranged marriage and a future of dull obscurity following her brother's journey to London, where eventually, pregnant and abandoned, and with no possible future available to her, she commits suicide. The options for a woman at the turn of the 20th century, Wolf argues, indeed that the 16th century, were very limited. Wolf goes on to describe many of the issues that women have to deal with. She even talks with some humour about the situation of lesbians. She herself being in a long-term relationship with Vita Sackville West, who were then subject to many laws designed to suppress their behaviour. And she added in the talk that she hopes that Sir Charles Byron, a noted enforcer of decency laws, was not in the audience. So, if you want to know what life was like for an intelligent, educated woman in 1929, if you want to understand the restrictions, the overweening, enforced dullness of existence that wealthy women had to endure, this book is an exceptional document, and she makes a lot of valid points. But, and here's the but, for each point she makes there's a rebuttal, there's a counter-argument. I'm not saying she's wrong, but there is a rebuttal, and I'm going to give three examples. That £500 private income she says she needed, is needed for someone like herself to become a writer. Let's put that in context. That sum of money that she says she needs. In 1929, the average miner earned 10 shillings a week, equivalent to 50 pence. His annual wage would be about £25 a year. So the average wage of a miner working 60, 70, 80 hours a week was the equivalent of 5% of that figure of £500 that Virginia Woolf needed. And from that, he'd be supporting a family. So the drudgery she railed against was nothing compared to the drudgery of the poor, both men and women. And I'm sure that a working-class woman who spent hours every day cooking and cleaning for a large family, or a factory worker who spent 6 days a week doing hard manual work in unsafe conditions, would have gladly swapped their grimy, physically taxing work for a bit of boredom and a wage that was 20 times what they were currently receiving. And George Orwell, a near contemporary of Woolf, wrote in the Wigan Pier, He describes seeing a woman, a young working-class woman, as he passed her on a train. And this gives the alternative side to that £500. He describes this young woman, he says, she had a round, pale face, the usual exhausted face of a slum girl who was 25 and looks 40, thanks to miscarriages and drudgery. And it wore, for the second I saw it, the most desolate, hopeless expression I have ever seen. So Wolfe's drudgery is, to put it kindly, relative. The second rebuttal I would give to her, to the point she makes, a room of one's own. In 1929, 70% of homes in Britain were rented. And within those rented homes, there might be two or three or four families living alongside each other, with at most two rooms each, a living room and a bedroom. So never mind, you know, a room of one's own. Most families didn't have a room, didn't have a home of their own. Never mind, you know, spare room to divvy out to a would-be writer. And while there were a handful of working-class writers from the time, very few were successful or remembered. You'd be lucky to remember any of the names. The only one I can think of is D.H. Lawrence, who was the son of a barely literate miner, but crucially, he had a mother who had been a teacher of sorts. And crucially, too, he was the winner of an education scholarship. It's worth asking how many other bright kids didn't win the scholarship and ended their days doing manual work, living a life of drudgery and poverty, their own dreams dashed just as surely as Julius Shakespeare's. Lawrence himself was enough of a writer to lampoon the excesses of the Bloomsbury set, of whom Virginia Woolf was a leading member. But Woolf was equally as critical of him, not least his reputation as a writer of sensual, masculine power. As she says of some of his work, and I'll quote here, "There was, to begin with, Trespassers, a hot, scented, overwrought piece of work, as it seemed. Then A Prussian Officer, of which no clear impression remained except of starting muscles and forced obscenity. Then The Lost Girl, a compact and seaman-like piece of work, stuffed with careful observation rather in the Bennett manner. Then one or two sketches of Italian travels of great beauty, but fragmentary and broken off. And then two little books of poems, Nettles and Pansies, which read like the sayings that small boys scribble upon stiles to make the housemaids jump and titter." Virginia could dish out faint praise with the best of them, and she did dish it out. And her perspective, though it might have been blinkered, it was a perspective that she wore those blinkers with style. And I'll go on to the third rebuttal that can be made of her work, very easily, which is race. Woolf inhabited a world that was almost as homogenous racially as it was in terms of class. "But I'm a white boy and I'm careful not to speak for those whose experiences I'll never live." So I'll quote Alice Walker, who said this: "Virginia Woolf, in the book A Room of One's Own, wrote that in order for a woman to write fiction, she must have two things, certainly: a room of her own with a lock and key, and enough money to support herself. But what then are we to make of Phyllis Wheatley, a slave who owned not even herself? This sickly, frail black girl who was required a servant of her own at times, her health was so precarious, and who, had she been white, would have been easily considered the intellectual superior of all the women and most of the men in society in her day." So the book A Room of One's Own, though perfectly valid within its own terms, has a limited perspective, class, money and race being the obvious things that she doesn't really get. It would be easy to make, to be honest, it would be easy to make a list of cheap and easy rebuttals. I could make 10 from this book. And every point will be easy to just tick off as we went, because let's face it, hindsight provides an excellent telescopic lens for the would-be cultural sniper, which I'm trying not to be. Maybe those rebuttals will be deserved, and maybe I could do a demolition job, but for one thing, the one thing that saves Virginia Woolf: the girl could write. Despite the obvious criticisms we can make, the book is an excellent read. Woolf is an excellent writer, and that for me mostly absolves her of her sins. I'm an avid reader, and the first thing I ask, the first thing I need to know of a writer is, can they write? Second, to be fair, is can they tell a story? But always first is, can they write? And she could. If you pick up a book, you'll just see she's a magnificent writer. And for sure, within the text of Room 101, Woolf is aware of the limitations of her argument. She acknowledges that others, without her social standing, would struggle even more. And in giving credit to those of lesser wealth than herself, something she wouldn't do in real life, it seems that Woolf, the writer, was a better person, a more fully rounded, more thoughtful creation than Woolf, the upper-class lady. So Wolfe was better in the abstract. Okay, so the book itself, A Room of One's Own, as good a reason to read as it is, it's a speech that she made to people like herself. She was playing to the gallery. She was amongst an audience of fellow blue stockings, that is, wealthy female intellectuals. And she needed to find a cause to complain. So she complained about being told off for walking on the grass at Cambridge, not being allowed into a library because she wasn't a man, and her belief that you needed an income of 20 times that of a Welsh miner in order to become a writer. Those complaints are not quite living on the edge. And for me, reading the book now, what I'm getting is a form of luxury radicalism in her work. It still abounds today, but it gave Wolfe enough material to write the short book about. It's not a best, but it's a document of a time and an outlook that still today, a century later, has echoes amongst the wealthy white radical class, what the Chinese disparagingly call the Bai Zuo, who are still desperately searching for a righteous cause. I think the central question she poses, though, how can we escape the manacles of form and culture put on us by society? How can we shrug off the weight of custom and expectation and just be ourselves? That is a luxury that most people still can't afford to ponder. And even if we find the time, the questions are basically unanswerable. Because I don't think we can evade the customs and restrictions short of moving to a desert island and living as a hermit. Everyone has ties. Everyone has links. We live in a social world whose rules we did not invent, but that we learned to get along with to a greater or lesser extent. And ironically, the friction generated by our struggle with those rules is often where great art is created. An example of that is this book. So whatever the criticism I've made of this book, and I've made a few, I do like her writing. I think she's a great writer. And if I've got mixed feelings about the book, I'm comforted by the knowledge that that she, Virginia Woolf, would have very clear and decidedly negative feelings about me. And on that bombshell, this is David West with producer Wilson and the 15-Minute Book Club. I'll see you next week for something completely different.